Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. The Reverend Professor Gary Baumer. Gary is Emeritus Professor of Sociology at Monash University. He's also an Anglican priest, active in parish ministry in Melbourne. And as an author and commentator, his book, Australian Soul, brought his expertise in both fields to bear on religion in Australia today. He had perhaps the added advantage of a little detachment. He was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and is a citizen of both the United States and Australia. Gary Baumer's primary research interests have been related to the topics of multiculturalism and religious pluralism. He holds the UNESCO Chair in Interreligious and Intercultural Relations in the Asia-Pacific, and he has also served in leadership roles in the World Conference of Religions for Peace and the Christian Research Association. Gary Baumer, welcome to Sunday Night.
Pleasure to be with you, John.
Gary, religious pluralism. It's the topic of the moment. I guess since 9/11, there's been a renewed impetus to the socio-political significance of religion. It's almost the topic du jour.
It has become the topic of the century. It began before 9/11, but 9/11 was a massive accelerant in making it obvious and something that had to be taken seriously. Because the way people have moved around the globe, called globalization, people have moved, ideas have moved, capital has moved, we now have much more diversity in almost every city and increasingly in rural areas. And that diversity takes many forms, including religious diversity. And how it is we relate to that is providing a great challenge and opportunity for creativity in the 21st century.
And I guess most significantly, for every action such as the ones you outline, there is a reaction, which has, of course, become the substance of considerable political concern.
Well, the action-reaction, yes, but it is part of the diversity. That is, there are people who like the diversity, those who don't like diversity, and that's part of diversity, ironically. And indeed, some of the diversity is within religious groups, as certain ideas, whether they're liberal, inclusive kinds of ideas, move as they do, or they're more constricting, fundamentalist kinds of ideas, where somebody says a real Christian or a real Buddhist or a real Muslim or something else does or doesn't do X, again, sets up a division within a particular religious group, which is part of the diversity we have to contend with.
Look, we'll return to some of those issues a little later, but can I ask you first, what sustains you in the priesthood? I mean, we're in a time when, whilst the interest in religion is high, the intellectual attacks on religion have never been publicly more acrimonious. Would it not, for you, as a sociologist, be more professionally and personally easy to distance yourself from the priesthood? I mean, people see this as a bit of a conundrum.
People have said, how can you possibly be a sociologist and a priest? Well, I can and I do, and so since that's what I do, anything is to explain is to reflect back on how I do that. They've both always been there since I was a child. Religion was very important. I, as a person, always felt very close to God, felt the presence of the sacred, felt very profoundly inspired by the sacred in many different forms. But my father was a sociologist, and so sociology was table talk. We argued theology and sociology at the table. And so both of those things were totally intertwined, bound up together from my birth.
That doesn't mean you didn't have some sort of intellectual struggle. I mean, the fact of stating it was at your birth can mean for some people, oh, well, I just accept it and that's the way it is. For others, it means, no, I've got to wrestle with who I am.
There's been wrestling all along. It's been a very active, lively conversation, both about the nature of society and the nature of God and relationships with both. And I've never put my mental capacity aside, I think most of the intellectual attacks on religion at the moment, yes, they're strident, they're acrimonious, but I don't think they're any more telling than they've ever been. If you don't want to believe that there's anything more than today, than what you can touch, feel, and see, okay, go ahead, believe that, but that's a belief. I do believe that there's more, and the exact form of that is often mysterious, but connecting with that in various religious ways, and for me, Christian ways, liturgically, sacramentally, continue to sustain my life, and that they aren't always utterly explicable intellectually doesn't leave me with a problem. It leaves me with a mystery. I don't take things easily, and I love wrestling with what Scripture says. And if somebody says this is a literal interpretation, you'll probably find me finding another one.
And this goes back not just to your family, but to your first parish experience. Because as I understand it, your first parish experience was in the heart of the action back in the 60s in the civil rights movement.
Absolutely. It was the Church of the Master Presbyterian in Harlem in New York City during the time of great civil disturbance. Some people called it police riots. That's what we called it. They called it race riots. But it was very, very difficult time. I was very familiar with slum life. My father had taken me into the slums of Chicago many times. I knew the smells of Pinosol sprayed into elevators to make you think they might be clean, the smell of garbage rotting, and there's nothing worse than a hot August night in New York City. It's damp, it's moist, it's you can't breathe the air, and the buildings radiate heat such that you could bake bread on them. And in that context, the crowding and the despair was huge.
And some of those areas at that time, it was almost a no-go area for white people.
You took care, and I always wore my collar, and that was then respected, and I was allowed to go. I also became known as someone who was ready to go, and I didn't shy away from going into some pretty difficult situations, but I was known as somebody who went and then was caring and compassionate. I was the Minister of Community Relations for Church of the Master, and it took me into the homes of people. The older people had come and had gotten jobs, thanks to Adam Clayton Powell, integrating the post office, which was a wonderful thing for many people. But their children had no opportunities either in school or in jobs, and they often were drug addicts. And so we spent a lot of time burying drug addicts as well as social engagement to better the situation.
Here is a church that was wedded to its community. How much does the civil rights movement in those days owe to the church?
It owed heavily to the church. Martin Luther King was a minister. There were ministers in the South and the North who took very courageous stands over against a larger voice of conservatives who said, arguing out of orders of creation, that blacks were lesser humans and were made to be hewers of wood and drawers of water. It was an unbelievable theological time, but that was done. And within that context, there were these churches who were open, who led the way, who led the demonstrations, who sacrificed, and in some cases sacrificed with their lives, for the cause of civil integration, of fairness, of honesty, of acceptance, of humanity. And that social justice theme has been very strong in all my life, but was very much exercised there.
How did it impact on you as somebody with an interest at that stage in sociology? I mean, were you professionally engaged with sociology at the same time?
Very much so, and studying the effects of various things. I did a research project on the impact of reading programs in during the summer school to assist maintenance of reading levels amongst students in New York City high schools. And those people who participated in a reading score program in the summer maintained their levels of reading capacity and went on from there. Those that didn't lost it. And that alone explained most of the difference between black and white learning curves in the New York City school system. And so the introduction of reading anything, and I mean anything, we at Church of the Master provided the most unbelievable reading material, but if they would read it, that's fine. It helped get them sustained and keep them learning through the summer.
Of course, this was at the time, too, of the if you look at the south of the United States, of busing, but also school integration, where the government stepped in and said, no, the choice is limited in some ways in that there should be equity of choice here, and that black students shouldn't be deprived because of the neighborhoods they're in. Extraordinarily contentious stuff.
It was. I mean, the denial of separate but equal was about 1954 in the Supreme Court, but working that out and making that happen, and the civil rights, there were three civil rights workers who were held up as heroes. They were killed in the South as I was in this parish, and the kids in the parish very much held them up as heroes. They had gone from New York City to the South to participate in civil rights demonstrations, and they lost their lives.
At the end of this period, around 1979, you came to Australia, and eventually Australia became home. What motivated the change?
I'd been in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I say being laundered for being let loose in Australia. For 10 years, I had enjoyed that. It had been good. It was a good experience. But my wife was offered a job at the top of her career in Melbourne and said that she would like to go. And I said, fine, I'm sure I can find something to do. That's the story.
The short answer. Having settled your wife in her profession, what did you find to do?
I was very fortunate at one level, and it cost me at another. I was associate professor of sociology and head of a school at Dalhousie. I came here and became a lecturer, which was the job that Monash offered me. And I took it. It was a radical cut in pay and status, but it allowed me the time to grow into Australia, to do basic research, to come to understand the nature of religious life here, to work my way through a couple of census rounds, to learn how to call the Australian census like a horse race with respect to religious identification, and to build up a reputation in that area and a solid academic foundation. The 80s were not easy for me in that way, but they really were well spent and well invested in that effort.
You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web. To the world, our guest is the Reverend Professor Dr. Gary Bowmer. And Gary is one of those who, coming from the United States, now calls Australia home, and more than that, has done an enormous amount to help us, we as Australians, understand our religious identity through books like Australian Soul and others. Gary, let's now talk about Australia, your period at Monash University, and also settling into Melbourne, because ultimately that produced, two or three years ago now, a book called Australian Soul, in which you, an American, dared to tap the depths of the Australian psyche, and particularly the spiritual side of the Australian psyche, and many people would say, that's an easy task, there is none. But you expressed it and took up the words of Manning Clark, a shy hope in the heart.
Yes, I mean, it was a challenge. It was a risk. It's been very rewarding to have people come and say, you know, you got it, Bauma. You put your finger on the way it is we are religious. And I had to get past that American notion. You stick the thermometer in and you come up with a spiritual reading and saying, this is a corpse. This is not alive. To detect the many ways of saying that there's more than, of relating to the more than, but most profoundly of dealing with hope. And what are the bases of hope? How is that held? And Manning Clark gets it so right, that we hold our hopes very shyly, very tenderly, close to the heart, and that's a kind of sacred poise, protective of our hopes. Why? Because some other Australian's going to mess with them.
does it go back to the experience of the country? Like you get America as these boundless horizons and this optimism. Yep. In Australia, you get away from the coast and you're in the desert. There's a fatalism that has to be associated with that, a caution.
The difference between the U.S. and Australia is huge, but there's also a difference between here and New Zealand and Canada, and I try to outline those as well. But we had such a hard beginning as Europeans, and for that matter, the indigenous people haven't had anything but a hard trot, too. And yet we have maintained a kind of hope. And it's not a kind of hope that says, an exuberant hope that says, I'm going to go and impose this hope on you, or I'm going to have to run over you to get this hope. It's always tenderly held as something to be nurtured, not something to be imposed on somebody else or beaten over on somebody else, or actually to put a bulldozer through to make it real. It's much more tender, and I think in that it's a beautiful kind of hope and spirituality to watch the tenderness in this and the care both for self and for other about hope.
So there is something to be said for at least a kernel of truth in those iconic films like Gallipoli and those films that actually did touch something that did resonate for Australians. Yep. That is, the hope is not necessarily one that, you know, everything in the garden's going to be lovely. It's a hope in the solidarity of your humanity almost.
It is, and it, in that sense, the sharedness of it, the, I hate the word, but the mateship involved in it, that's not a masculine term, that's something that all Australians participate in, and it stands as so foundational a value that when things come up that rub against that, like what we do with the refugees, like other kinds of discriminations, or where some religious group might want to impose some moralistic kind of thing on the society, the reaction against that is not just that of a larrikin. The reaction against it is, hey, hold it, you're hurting some Australians, and we don't like that because we feel they're hurt. And there is that profound webbing of understanding and mutuality, I think, here that's it's really beautiful to see when it works.
There is a caution about extreme individualism.
There's that, too. It's not just the person on their own, because the person on their own wouldn't have survived. In the very early days, the person on their own didn't survive. And so there's a realization that we need each other and that we need newcomers. And we've been really good, actually, at taking that kind of hope and that camaraderie and saying, yeah, come on along. We need you to help us build the society, to live together, to sustain ourselves in this place.
Because that's the other thing it leads us to, is that one can have a moment where one defines, say, a spirituality or a sensibility of a people that might be there, but it's never rock solid. It's not immutable. So you might say, well, look, here is something of enormous value, and others will say, yes, but the very nature of the changing society means those core values are put at risk. And the question is, to what extent are we totally mutable as a society, or do things just remain there as part of the substance of who and what you are?
I don't think we're totally mutable at all. I think, yes, change does challenge, but what we've discovered, I mean, if you just look at, I would take any slice of time, but particularly from 1947 on, and the kinds of changes we've absorbed and the kinds of discussions we've had, they've all centered around the same thing of who will we accept today? Who will we fully accept today that we were having troubles with before? I watched a wonderful thing at Monash in 1980 when I was there teaching. I had a tutorial, half the students said the other half weren't Australians. And so the other half that weren't Australians were, in this case, Greek and Italians. And I said, well, what's an Australian? And then we all agreed with Rolf Harris that Australian is somebody you call Australia home, because half my congregation at St. John's Terrac did not call Australia home, even though they've been here for five generations. So we went around, and these Greeks and Italians said, look, I was born here. I call Australia home. And the other side said, oh, okay, you're Australian. But there was that was a kind of move like a cold change in Melbourne, going through and just seeing that at these groups had suddenly become Australia.
Actually, it's defined by the number of non-Australian or Anglo-Celtic names that appear in football teams.
Well, there's another good measure. So that the genius of this culture and society, which nobody constructed, but grew out of the convict experience, grew out of the early days, and continues to grow out of our experience, is very foundational. And I think it's actually, it's not rigid, hard rock, but it's the way we work. And to watch people come in and be trained into that, to learn about that, and that's what we say, what we mean when we say, oh, such and such a group has to become Australian. Somewhat like us, but mostly like us in the way we process. That is, in an accepting, understanding, welcoming, ready to learn, looking, observing, and hopeful.
When you look at church attendance these days, church attendance has gone down rapidly since the 1960s. You see that also in over the last couple of weeks. You've had the ACTU agonizing about the collapse in union membership. We are seeing a change in society that is a more individualized, atomized society, which some people would say that goes to the heart of who we are. We're becoming a different sort of society. Mateship is no longer me in solidarity with my mates. Mateship is now defined as something else. It's basically, well, look, if somebody's really down and out, you might throw a penny in the cup to look after them. But, you know, ultimately we're individuals first.
Well, there's no question that voluntary associations like churches, unions, lodges are having trouble sustaining attendances. But they aren't the only form of social solidarity by any means. And I think that we, those who say because those forms are going, we are no longer have a social solidarity, no longer care for each other, aren't observing what's going on. There are many other forms. I can't nominate them all because we don't have the research to tell us what people are in fact doing. Right. But if I look at my students, if I look at my children and so on, and the kinds of networks of association there, are building, the kinds of things that sustain them. No, they are not church. No, they are not a union. No, they are not a lodge. But they are there nonetheless. And some of them are actually virtual. That is, they are Facebook. Like it or not, those relationships have a reality level that isn't terribly different from an old congregation. I mean, how real was Myrtle to you when she sat 15 rows away? We don't give credit to the way our young people are actually forming these things, and to the kinds of causes to which they give their energies, not their lives. Nobody volunteers for life for anything anymore, but Tuesday will do. And they get things done. I'm impressed. I mean, there's a Interfaith Youth Corps, which has been going now for 5 or 6 years, which is doing a terrific job. Is it organized in the old-fashioned way? No. Will it be here in 10 years? I'm not sure. But right now, it's here, it's working, it's providing networks, it's doing a great job.
Well, yes, and perhaps maybe you could argue long-term will answer this, of course, that high-level, short-term contractual engagement provides more sustainability and capacity for change than low-level, long-term commitment.
Well, how many kids in the olden days found Methodist weekend retreats terribly transformative?
For some things.
They were good for a whole lot of things, John, and you know that. I think those people who comment on the fact that the churches aren't full, first of all, forget that they probably never were. And secondly, yes, we're in real trouble in the main line because of the aging pattern of worshipers is such that anybody under 40 walking in would say, hey, this is not me, to many, many, many places. There are exceptions, and there's some very interesting ones, and they aren't all Hillsong, although Hillsong's one. There are other places, often tied, that have schools next door, some Anglican parishes, where they've got a cross-section of people, and people are there for the worship. Now, that's rare. That's not going to take over. That's not going to be like it used to be, but it's not going to entirely go away either.
You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio Around Australia. Our guest is the Reverend Professor Gary Bomer, who is something of a reflector on both church and society, Professor of Sociology at Monash University for many years, now Emeritus Professor, and long-term engagement with the World Conference of Religions and Peace and the Christian Research Association. Gary, let's talk a little about your long-term interest as a sociologist and as a priest. Pluralism. And let me go straight to the heart of it. These days in Europe, we're seeing an argument over the impact of pluralism. You see it in France in the recent elections. You see it particularly in Holland. You see it in a shadow form in Britain. There is an argument going here that in academia stems back about 10 years to a famous essay called The Clash of Civilizations. People are now saying this is working itself out in the modern European context, and beware, we in Australia are going to face some of the same difficulties.
The Clash of Civilizations, good old Huntington, was about 20 years now, John. It's unbelievable. But I love watching Europe, and one of the fun things is that the churches in Paris are full. Now, that's a shocking thing. Most Parisians are so secularist, and most Parisian sociologists are so secularist. When I mention this, they just get embarrassed. But part of what's happening there is as religious diversity becomes palpable in places like Paris, in places like Denmark, it puts up the question of, well, if you are a Muslim, who am I? And I think part of that is a driver to saying, well, I must be Christian because I'm part of this very historically Christian place. Look at all these churches. And do I do something to express that? I think in Paris they are. Besides which, they're doing a pretty good job of keeping the liturgy alive, and they found some young priests. Where they found them, I don't know, but that they have. Denmark, 85% of Danes are confirmed as Lutherans. They never go to church, but if anybody asks, what are you? I'm Lutheran or I'm Christian. So diversity throws up the meaning of a religious identity.
Well, and that question is now becoming more vital for people.
It's becoming more vital, and I'm dying for the census results to come out in Australia, and which they will in the latter part of June, to see whether a similar thing's happening here. Are people more likely to express a religious identity than they were before? I don't care what it is, just I'm something, rather than either ignoring the question, like 10% tended to have done, or saying no religion, as many do. Well, it'll be interesting to watch. Now, that's one side of it. The other side is in this diversity, of course, there are views that don't agree. Or there are views of one group that wants to impose on another. Or there are groups who have been accustomed to having either informal or formal avenues of power and control and shaping in the society, which they feel they're losing. And when that happens, they get quite strident because they feel, in fact, they sometimes put it this way, we're losing our freedom of religion. Oh, my goodness. And often that amounts to the freedom to discriminate or the freedom to deny services to someone or to shape the moral frame of the society. And no, in Australia, that is not possible. It is not possible for one group to do this, although in the past there have been groups that pretty well did do this.
The clearest expression of this in Britain came with a famous confrontation with a British Minister of State under the previous Labour regime when a woman came to see him fully veiled, and he asked that she remove the veil to speak to him because he said, whilst you have that veil on your face, I cannot deal with you as a citizen. You know, you may want to use it in your religious practice, but we operate as a civil society on the basis of identity. And if your identity is obscured from me, I cannot deal with you. Now, that was a pretty clear and stark definition of the way some people identify these issues.
It is a very clear one. It's also a very complex one. I'm dealing with you, John, over about 1,000 kilometers away. We have seen each other's face, but we don't see it at the moment. I don't know what your kind of a face you're pulling. We cope quite well with that. We cope many times with conversations over the phone, even with people we've never met before. So the face thing is at one level a furphy. The veiling thing is, in our society, something that is very differently interpreted by different groups. And I wish we would allow those who veiled to have their own self-definition of why. Some feminists say, well, veiling represents repression. Well, it might or might not. I know women who veil because that's the way they want to look. The covering of the face is slightly different. That's edgy. I also know that in Australia, the officials of the Muslim community, the Muslim leaders say, listen, if you are driving a car and you are asked to show your face to see if it's your license plate, you show your face. And so there is within the community itself a pretty fundamental understanding that to deny to show face in the context of either a court case or something else is being pretty radical, pretty way out on the edge and extreme. Again, how then do you respect? And it's a wonderful case, because how then do you respect the beliefs and practices of someone who is out on the extreme? Do you just say you're an extremist and we don't do that, we don't respect that here? Or do you say, all right, how do I now respect you and your needs for this? Is there some way that we can? Rather than saying, I am not able to deal with you, if that's the case, and perhaps I better hand the case over to somebody who can. You know, if I can't cope with X or Y or Z about you, then I'd better have somebody down the hall who can. And I think in a highly diverse society, we're going to have to find opportunities to do that as various religious and other kinds of beliefs and practices come in to say, I personally can't do this, but you might find it down, or you will find it down the hall in Susan Brown's office or whatever else. I mean, just...
Here also we get confusions over things like pluralism and relativism and other issues impinging. And I'd just like to touch on a couple of those.
Yeah.
First of all, the difference between religion and culture is something that's very difficult to tease out here. Some people would say, look, the trouble with either a large inrush of Vietnamese boat people back in the 70s or a large rush of Muslims from Afghanistan or whatever now is that there is a difficult and deep confusion that goes on, that people confuse the culture from which a person has come and where they're educated, where they have a broad civil society, with the religious values the people hold. And to tease those apart, and some people would say, well, look, they're Muslim, they've come from this country, they can't possibly adopt a democratic model because they've never had a democratic model to work with, and it goes to the heart of their faith. And others say, no, you're confusing culture and religion here. Now, this is a deep confusion that exists, and many people, including some in Europe, would say, no, it's civilizational. You see, they can't because they're not of that civilization.
Oh, we could... the issue of democracy is a very, very funny one. I've got a book on democracy and Islam, which covers these things. But the distinction between religion and culture is extremely difficult to make. There is no culture-free religion. Every religion, to use a Christian concept, is incarnate within a particular culture. I was raised in the Dutch Reform, in a form of the Dutch Reformed Church. We were as Dutch as blazes, and my grandmother actually thought God spoke Dutch. Now, we can laugh at that, but it wasn't a laughing matter for this group as they became increasingly American and tried to figure out what was cultural and what was religious, et cetera, et cetera. They're still trying to figure it out. And I can still, it's very clear. It's a particular form. Anglicanism has a very English base, et cetera, et cetera. And to say that somehow Australian Anglicanism has, gotten itself free of its British roots, well, get over it. Have another look. And so on and so forth. Well, Islam from Pakistan will have a variety of forms, because there isn't just one form there. Islam from Turkey or from Tunisia, again, will have a variation on the themes of Tunisian culture and Islamic belief and practice, which take a particular form. Now, Muslims here in Australia have a wonderful opportunity, and in fact many of them are taking it, to say, okay, what is Australian Islam? We can construct it, because we're from 62 different nationality backgrounds, to say nothing of a whole host of cultural backgrounds and linguistic backgrounds. Will we construct something that is distinctively Australian Islam. Well, it may take them 100 years, but then, goodness, we've been working at Christianity here for a long time and still trying to get it that way. So I find that to say that there is a distinction that has to be made, on the one hand, is impossible. And on the other hand, it simply provides an opportunity to be comparative about the way these various strands of things, what might be called cultural and things that might be called religious, get bound together. And yes, some are more easily discarded, shoved off, than others. And it's part of the grand continuous evolution of the ways people are being religious.
And it's the time frame that becomes problematic for many people. That is, if we look back and see the way the Irish, then the Italians and the Greeks were absorbed into Australian society, you can see it's generational, whereas the time frame that constantly we're encouraged to look at these days, particularly by the media and news cycle, yes, is, you know, it's only 3 days away.
It's instant, yes. No, but we used to say the same thing about Catholics, of course. They couldn't sustain democracy. So, I mean, the whole business of these cultures and religious and democratic practice, etc., most religions move from place to place and learn how to be in the new place.
What then do you see of the sustained future of religion? You seem to be indicating that institutional religion, as it's been known in Australia, particularly through the Christian churches, may continue to decline, but religion and Christianity as part of that will constantly find new ways to express itself.
Yes, I don't think there's any question about that. The churches are one institutional form of Christianity. We have huge other things, including our welfare services, health services, educational services that are very faith-based and still tied to that and somewhat informed by it. The forms will change. There will also be continuity. As I said, there are these Anglican parishes offering very straight up and down prayer book services that are well done and well attended, and the people find them, people of all ages find them fulfilling. Then there are places like Hillsong, which have a very massive kind of attendance and provide that kind of effervescence and that kind of boost to the notion that you're not alone, that there's a lot of people doing this, and hey, some of them are under 20. It's a very different kind of experience. That may be sustained, but whether it will sustain the same membership, I don't know. That is, people flow through where they go, we don't know yet either, because we haven't had that phenomenon with us long enough to map clearly where people go when they leave. For those who do leave, where do they go? We will have, I think, an increasingly diverse religious life with mosques, with Buddhist temples, Hindus are going to be over 1% of the population in the next census. We're going to have increasing Hindu presence. So that's part of the diversity. It won't, I don't think, fill up the gap made by non-attendance of Christian churches, but it will keep a very diverse, firm foundation of a variety of religious practices, beliefs, etc., within the Australian frame, so that being religious will be something that is relatively easy to do. The only question is, which way are you going to do it today?
Does it in some ways play back to maybe to an advantage in the Australian sensibility, as you indicated, in Australian Soul, that it goes to that distinction that people like Henry Lawson were able to see, that Henry Lawson had no time for formal religion, but throughout his poetry you constantly get his consistent admiration for that working priest or parson out in the bush who chewed up his life in the service of others, and that religion is valued in that Australian context by its commitment, as you found in the streets of New York, to the people first. Do it and then I'll listen to you, but don't come preaching and wagging your finger at me.
That's absolutely true. I mean, Australians, probably other people as well, are very much moved by sacrificial living tending to the needs of others, being open to the needs of others. And that is, as we say, a theme in our literature. It's a theme that goes beyond, but is there in many of the early clergy who very much sacrificed their lives and their well-being in order to plant churches, to extend churches, to make this available. And among them, there were many who were very humane, open to human need, and very concerned. The institutional side has always been problematic. Reading a history of Australia, only to discover that in the early part of the 20th century, when there were, still were very few clergy, particularly in the bush or in the flung suburbs, where it was difficult to get fragile newborns baptized, those babies that died in infancy were not allowed to be buried in churchyards. That kind of uncaring stuff, that kind of stuff which comes in, as you say, wagging the finger and being condemnatory and using shame is simply something that Australians actually avoid vigorously, do not tolerate, and will stand away from, which is foundational to that rejection of the institutional forms of religion. People who have sacrificed, who have given, and we could list names, both contemporary ones and otherwise, who are heroes of faith to Australians and stand out. And then there are others who have just been shoring up the institution for the sake of the institution, and they stand out, they are seen, and seen for what they are, and people turn away from it.
Does it sound a warning for the way the churches should respond to these current debates over sexuality, particularly the gay marriage debate as it's being played out?
I think it does, absolutely. I mean, Jesus was highly critical of the institution of religion in his day. He saw it as getting in the way of grace, God's grace, getting in the way of God's love. And when he saw that happen, he got furious. And so I, too, get furious when I see the institution engaging in condemnatory behaviors and not being ready to sit and listen and to engage with those who are different in whatever way. Whether they're different in faith or different in sexuality, different in race, to engage and understand how God is working with them. To presuppose that God is not working with them flies in the face of all kinds of evidence. I love the example of Jesus with the woman at the well in Samaria. Just to say those things, is Jesus going across so many boundaries, barriers, against so much prejudice and hatred within his own society, you can't believe it. And the only contemporary example I can think of, it's like Fred Nile going and getting on a float in a gay Mardi Gras and saying, hey, let's talk about this. God loves you.
And also the much maligned St. Paul. I mean, St. Paul was the one who actually dealt with the great taboo, and that was the exclusivism of the Jewish community, and put aside circumcision. I mean, these are an extraordinary
And he had to fight with Peter over this, and Peter probably never really gave in his heart, but Peter and the Gospels we've been reading Sunday mornings has been encountered this the Spirit being shown in the Gentiles. How is this possible? They're not circumcised. They're not us. And it's clear that God's working in these people. How can we withhold baptism, says Peter? Well, how can we withhold marriage from those in whom God is clearly giving the gifts of that sort of relationship?
Gary Balmer, it's been great to have you on Sunday night. Thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure, John. Indeed.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.